sutta for this week, the Karnakantala Sutta, and a somewhat curious little sutta. I'm not sure if we might have enough time at the end to move on to the next sutta this afternoon. This particular sutta for some reason, I'm not quite sure. Is that in focus? Or is it my eyes? I don't know. Is that the focus? That's the focus. And has a parallel in the Madhyama Agama, and for some reason not noticed by Venerable Anālaya, but according to Sutta Central, it has another parallel in the Tibetan Dulba, the Tibetan Mulsarasivada Vinaya, for those of you who read Tibetan. So this completes a series of discourses which between the Buddha and dialogues between the Buddha and King Pasenadi, who we have come to know and love as being a kind of well-meaning but bumbling and somewhat ineffectual king. And this particular sutta very much reinforces that particular stereotype. On the screen today we have Venerable Tanisaro's translation from Access to Insight. I'll be reading from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, so but this one is clearer to read on the screen anyway, but has a nice introduction here. The frame story of this sutta represents a gentle satire of royal life. Despite his position, King Pasenadi of Kosala must still act the role of messenger for his wives. Because of his position, he finds himself surrounded by people he cannot trust. He never gets to the bottom of the question of who brought misinformation into the palace, and whose minds fasten on issues of overthrowing and banishing, possibly him. He's so preoccupied with his responsibilities that he doesn't pick up on the Buddha's gentle joke about his servitude to the sisters Soma and Sakula, can't stick with an issue for any length of time, sometimes can't even phrase his questions properly, and can arrive at no greater certainty about the Buddha's teachings than that they seem reasonable. At the end of the sutta he has to leave, not because he has exhausted the issues he'd like to discuss, but because one of his courtiers tells him it is time to go. All in all, not an enviable position. The substance of the discussion, however, does touch on some serious themes, serious issues. The topic treated in greatest detail concerns the differences among the castes of the Buddha's time, and the Buddha's remarks can profitably be applied to issues of racism in ours. And should be superfluous to add, but obviously he's not superfluous to add, other kinds of isms as well, especially sexism. The discussion and the frame story, of course, play off one another. Because of his social position, King Pasenadi is unable to pursue the path to release that is open to all regardless of race or caste. His social advantages are a spiritual liability. Like many people in the modern world, he has plenty of things but no time. To move on to the sutra itself, as I said, I'll be reading from this one, so we can see if there are any... I'll be reading from Bhikkhu Bodhi's version, so if there are any major differences, we can note them. The one I noticed straight away is Bhikkhu Bodhi has the town listed as Ujjunya, whereas according to Tanisaro's translation, it's Udanya. This is the Burmese Pali text here, and that has Urunya. Ujjunya, Urunya, or Udanya. Okay? So we have three different names in the Pali text. Well, how many do we have in the Chinese? I think it's probably a name that only occurs in this place. I'm not familiar with it. And it's just some probably meant to be the same place, but just a textual confusion for some reason. It's possibly like a dialectical name. Got confused in the transcription. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Ujjunya at the Karnakatala Deer Park. Now, on that occasion, King Pasenadi of Kosala had arrived at Udyunya for some business or other. Then he told a man, "Come, good man, go to the Blessed One and pay homage in my name with your head at his feet and ask whether he is free from illness and affliction and is healthy, strong and abiding in comfort, saying, 'Venerable Sir, King Pasenadi of Kosala pays homage.' And say this, 'Venerable Sir, today King Pasenadi of Kosala will come to see the Blessed One after he has had his breakfast.' 'Yes, sire,' the man replied. He went to the Blessed One, paid homage, sat down and delivered this message. The sisters Soma and Sakula heard, 'Today King Pasenadi will go to see the Blessed One after he has had his breakfast.' Then while the meal was being served, the two sisters went to the king and said, 'Sire, pay homage in our name with your head at the Blessed One's feet and ask whether he's free from illness.' And they said, and say to him, 'Venerable Sir, the sisters Soma and Sakula pay homage with their heads at the Blessed One's seat.'" And so after he finished his breakfast, King Pasenadi then went to the Blessed One, paid homage, and sat down at one side and delivered the message of the two sisters. And the Buddha said, "Great King, couldn't the sisters Soma and Sakula find another messenger?" The Buddha. And so he told him the story, and the Buddha said, "Well, may the sisters Soma and Sakula be happy, great king." Okay, so that's the kind of the introduction, and as sort of seems to be kind of brought out in there, that's a slightly well, slightly curious. But the
sorry, I haven't made this. Didn't actually read that. The Buddha said, "Why didn't they send their own messenger?"
That's the king just told him the story. Well, they just related the circumstances. But the one of the things, the interesting things about this particular sutta, I mean, it's a very curious sutta, and it's got all these kind of slightly weird episodes like this one, which is just a little bit kind of unusual, and it sort of breaks from one topic to another, and people are coming and going, and never actually develops any theme or anything like that. And all in all of these things which make it seem, in fact, incredibly realistic.
Yes.
And the whole kind of, I mean, this is so, it's so kind of such a kind of personal kind of odd thing to put in here, you know, these two sisters who are living in the palace, and they get the king to make a message. It doesn't actually contribute to the sutta in any way, but it sort of gets in there. So all these things to me add realism to it. So according to the commentary, the two sisters are some of the sisters of each other. Obviously, they're not sisters of the king, but they're some of the king's wives. Pick up some milk while you're there. So Venerable Analio discusses the question of whether this which was the first occasion when Pasenadi met the Buddha, and according to the Pali tradition, there's a sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya which records the first meeting of the Buddha and King Pasenadi. But in that one, in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Sanyutta Agama version depicts that as being not the first visit, whereas this one here, in some respects, seems to be the first visit, but in other respects not, so it's not quite clear. For example, in the Chinese one, Pasenadi addresses the Buddha by his personal name of Gotama, which is usually only used by people who are not actual disciples of the Buddha. But in the Pali one, he uses the Blessed One. So, obviously, which is only used by disciples, so it's not entirely, the situation's not entirely clear. Well, she was the one who introduced him to the teaching as such, but not necessarily introduced him to the Buddha personally. Yeah. So, it's just not entirely clear. Sorry? Yeah, so he's reporting a third person saying, so it's a little bit different now. So here's the little saying, Sukhaniyo hod pontu ta maharaja soma cha bhagini sakula cha bhaginiti. May the sisters Soma and Sakula be happy. It's quite unusual, that little blessing phrase like that. So you find it a few times, but not very common. Okay, so moving on to the subject. King Prasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, I have heard this. The recluse Gotama says, there is no recluse or Brahman, no Samana or Brahman, who is omniscient and all-seeing, who can claim to have complete knowledge and vision. That is not possible. Venerable Sir, do those who speak thus say what has been said by the Blessed One and not misrepresent him with what is contrary to fact? Do they explain in accordance with the Dhamma in such a way that nothing that provides a ground for censure can be legitimately deduced from their assertions? Okay, so this is a stock passage which is as convoluted in the Pali as it is in the translation, but it's actually it's in one of the Vinaya or Padimokkha rules as well. Great King, those who say that I'm not speaking in line with what I have said and I'm misrepresenting me with what is untrue and unfactual. Okay. So he asked, is it possible to have... Essentially, he asked, is it... he says that the Buddha's been reported as saying it's not possible to be omniscient. And the Buddha says, this is not what I've said. Okay. Now then, King Prasenadi turns to General Vidudava and says, who brought this topic into the palace? And he says, Sanjaya, the Brahmin of the Akasa clan. So Vidudava, of course, being King Prasenadi's son, and of course being the who later overthrew him in the Dhammacetti Sutta, which we read last week, or the week before, who overthrew the king, and Vidudava, of course, being in a hurry to blame someone else, very convenient. Then Prasenadi of Kosala told the man, come, good man, in my name, tell Sanjaya, the Brahman of the Akasa clan, Venerable Sir, King Prasenadi of Kosala calls you. Yes, sire, the man replied. He went to Sanjaya, the Brahman of the Akasa clan, and told him, Venerable Sir, King Prasenadi of Kosala calls you. Meanwhile, King Prasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, so this whole kind of conversation's going on, meanwhile someone's going to be fetched and so on. Meanwhile, King Prasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, could something else have been said by the Blessed One referring to that, and the person understood it wrongly? In what way does the Blessed One recall making that utterance? I recall having actually made the utterance in this way, Great King, there is no recluse or Brahman who knows all, who sees all simultaneously. That is not possible. What the Blessed One, and Prasenadi replies, what the Blessed One has said appears reasonable. What the Blessed One has said appears to be supported by reason. There's no one who can know and see all simultaneously. Okay, so the simultaneously here, nati so, here's the actual statement, nati so samano, there is no samana, ascetic or monastic or something, or Brahman, your sakideva, so sakideva is means all at once, it's got nothing to do with the word deva, it's got nothing to do with the word deva, it's actually saki. D is just a connection consonant. Sabam nyasati, all knowing and all seeing, that is not possible. Okay, and the response when he says it's reasonable, literally the word here is hetu rupang bhante bhagava aha, sahetu rupang bhante bhagava. So hetu being word meaning a root or a cause, and rupa. Normally we translate as form, here translate it often means seeming, which is actually very interesting semantically, because the word rupa literally comes from like an appearance, like what you see. So the things that you see with your eyes are called rupas, and from there it comes to mean on the one hand materiality. Okay, but we from a Western point of view we think of materiality as substance. So, but in Pali, materiality is seeming or appearance. And so the word rupa also means, as well as meaning substance or physicality, it also means seeming. So this is seemingly reasonable. Okay, so it's hetu rupang, it seems reasonable. Hetu is reason, yeah. Yeah, seems to be reasonable. Okay, so... So this is obviously, quite a significant statement on the nature of omniscience, So the Buddha, of course, the general psychology of the suttas is that you can only be aware of one sense door at a time. So seeing, hearing, or so on. So you couldn't be able to know and see everything all the time. But the answer also, when evaluating the answer, also remember that the Buddha very frequently said that the all, the sabbang, is the all that can be experienced through the six senses. Okay? So in answering this, he's not necessarily saying he can see or understand everything in the whole universe, but saying everything which is experienceable through the six senses. Okay, so even that limited understanding of omniscience is still, you can't experience them all simultaneously. Okay. Simultaneous, all at one time. Okay?
And so much happens off stage. And so much innuendo.
Yeah, that's true.
Seems to be quite pertinent to this particular statement. Because the question arose in the Dhamma Sutta, is that why didn't the Buddha warn?
Yeah, very true. Yeah.
You know, so much is going on. Yeah. So much is going on in the city that we can't see.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
And then each of these exchanges between Sandy and the Buddha, the Sandy is always saying, it appears reasonable, it's supported by reason.
Yeah.
But that's just what we can see.
Yeah. And what you explicitly don't see is the machinations of Vidudaba and his people who are sort of trying to hide their actions.
Yeah.
Even something very simple, like kind of question. But that's maybe why they were discussing it. That raises a question. Vidudaba and his counselors are sitting in the palace, thinking of some way to overthrow the king. And somebody says, "But isn't the Buddha going to know exactly what we're talking about?"
Yeah. Well, there's also the question that Vidudaba asked
earlier on about Yeah, which is very pertinent. So, very political subtext going on here. So for those of you who weren't here, we looked at last week, the Dhammacetti Sutta actually should be in the reverse order. It should be read in the reverse order, but the Dhammacetti Sutta is the one where Vidudaba abandons the King Pasenadi in his conversation with the king and goes off and... Oh, sorry, the general abandons... Is Vidudaba himself? No, it's the general, isn't it, who's given the king's insignia, Karayana, Diga Karayana, has given the king's insignia, but then abandons him while he's in session with the Buddha and goes off and crowns Vidudaba as the king. So there's this kind of quite potent political machinations going on behind these seemingly innocent questions. So the next one goes on to a discussion on the four castes, and a very common topic of conversation in the suttas. There are these four castes, or four varnas, four classes. Varna literally meaning colour. So the notion of caste possibly originally having a racial connotation. Kshatriya is the warrior caste, Brahman being the priestly caste, Vaisya, merchant castes, and Sudra, the workers. So Vaisya in a sense is like the middle class, really. And here it's Pasenadi speaking, and he noticed that he puts the Kshatriyas first. So typically when the Buddha is speaking, he'll put the Kshatriyas first and then the Brahmins. And when the Brahmins are speaking, of course, they'll put the Brahmins first and then the Kshatriyas. Two of them. And so according to, back to Pasenadi's question, there are these four castes. Two of them, is there any distinction or difference among them? Okay, there are these four castes of the two, says the Buddha, two of the four castes, two of them, that is the noble and the Brahmins, are held to be superior since men pay homage to them, rise up for them, and accord them reverential salutation and polite services. So this is the they're obviously treated in a conventional manner in society, conventionally treated in a better manner in society. So there's that kind of conventional distinction between them. To which Pasenadi responds, "I'm not asking about this present life. I'm asking about the life to come. There are these in the future life. There are these. Is there any distinction between these four castes?" I don't know. Perhaps he's worried. he's asking this question. The question of the castes, obviously being the foremost social or cultural question at the time of the Buddha, and it's, I think, essential that we see these things and use them to apply principle, or to see whether there are similar principles that can be applied for the social problems that we're encountering in our own day. So the Buddha said, "Great King, there are these five factors of striving." What five? "Here a bhikkhu has faith. He places his faith in the Tathagata's enlightenment thus, that the Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable, leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed." Of course, the Itipiso formula. Then that's the first factor of striving, is having strong faith in the Buddha. Second one is that one is free from illness and affliction, possessing a good digestion that is neither too cool nor too warm, but medium, and able to bear the strain of striving. Then he is honest and sincere and shows himself as he actually is to his teacher and his companions in the holy life. Then he's energetic in abandoning unwholesome dhammas and in undertaking wholesome dhammas, steadfast launching his effort with firmness and persevering in cultivating wholesome dhammas. Then he is wise, he possesses wisdom regarding the rise and fall, that is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. These are the five factors of striving. And the Buddha then goes on, "As for the four castes, great king, the nobles, Brahmins, merchants and workers, if they possess these five factors of striving, it would lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time." So it's a somewhat long-winded way of getting around to it, but I think you get the message. So then the next question, Pasenadi asks, "If these four castes possess the five factors of striving, would there then be any difference among them in that respect?" And the Buddha then says, "Well, I say that there would be a difference in terms of the diversity of their striving. Suppose that there were two tameable elephants, or tameable horses, or tameable oxen that were well tamed and well disciplined, and two tameable elephants, or tameable horses, or tameable oxen that were untamed and undisciplined. What do you think? Would those two, the two tameable elephants and so on that were well tamed, acquire the behavior of the tamed, and would they arrive at the grade of the tamed?" "Yes, venerable sir." "And would those tameable elephants, being untamed, reach the same grade as those who are well tamed and well disciplined?" "So too, great king," and Pasenadi answers, "No, venerable sir." "So too, great king," goes on the Buddha, "it is not possible, but what can be achieved by one who has faith, who has free from illness, who is honest and sincere, who is energetic, who is wise, can be achieved by one who has no faith, who has much illness, who is fraudulent and deceitful, who is lazy and who is not wise." Okay, so the point of this, again, it's a slightly obscure phrasing, but basically I think the point is that with the four castes, that there's no real intrinsic difference between them, but if they're endowed with the potential to live a good life, or to, as it says, to exert in the five factors of striving, then they all have equal potential, but it really depends on what they choose to do with that. And again, then Pasenadi responds by saying again that the Blessed One has said appears reasonable. He then goes on to ask another question. If they had these factors of striving, and if they actually strove correctly, then would there be any difference among them in that respect? Buddha responds quite unequivocally, "Here, great king, in this respect I say that among them there is no difference. that is, between the deliverance of one and the deliverance of the others. Suppose a man took a dry saka wood, lit a fire and produced heat, and then another man took dry sala wood, lit a fire and produced heat, and another man, saka being teak, then another man took dry mango wood, lit a fire and produced heat, and then someone else took a dry fig wood, lit a fire and produced heat. What do you think, great kings? Would there be any difference among these fires lit with the different kinds of wood, that is, between the flame of one and the flames of the others, or between the colour of one and the colours of the others, or between the radiance of one and the radiances of the others? No, venerable sir. So too, great king, when spiritual fire is kindled by energy, lit by striving, then there is, I say, no difference between the deliverance of one and the deliverance of the others. Which two similes?
Well, one, the...
Oh, the elephant and so on,
yeah,
and then
the animals with those two kinds of flames.
Mm-hmm.
So in the second case, the flame is pretty much going to be exactly the same.
Pretty much universal, yeah.
Yeah, but animals are still quite different.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Yeah, could be, yeah.
And they have to be as...
Actually, different wood does
but perhaps...
Where's the faith? Obviously, it wasn't the case in ancient India.
That's what we're trying to incorporate.
No, but it's true.
Some complexity.
Yeah, yeah. That's very common with the similes. They have a depth of implications which you wouldn't, you know, not apparent on the surface. In fact, that's almost the point of using the similes. Yeah, but I think you're quite right. The first one, the animals, looks quite diverse, and the Buddha actually uses that elsewhere. That same simile, and says that you know, humanity is not like the animal realm, in that when we're, the animals sort of have their nature according to how they're born, whereas humans have their nature according to how they choose to live their lives. Yeah.
Because I was thinking in terms of, there is no difference with regard to the race, but for example, when people ask the question of why was Buddha born in a Kafir case?
Yeah.
Good answer to that, but if you're convincing of it,
well,
you were born in the Sutta case,
then nobody
would listen to it.
Right.
And
even if you were fully
released,
it's fine.
But
it would still be like a
more
animal.
Yeah,
a dog.
Dog
yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, but Buddha, we asked the question first, people to answer. There was a difference in the way it was passed
through. Yeah. It's interesting, I mean, that whole process of that, it's quite subtle actually, because the first one he quite openly acknowledges there is a difference, and then the middle cases he's saying, well, there kind of could be or could not be, and then by the end when it's talking about the release, he's saying quite unequivocally, no, there's no difference. Okay? So this part of the sutra is pretty straightforward. And the next part is a little bit weird. Now, then he goes on, King Pasenadi goes on to say, but Bhante, are there devas? Okay. Oh, sorry, just a little point I should make about the Pali a bit earlier. When King Pasenadi said, I'm not asking about this life, I'm asking about future lives, this is the phrasing that he used. Remember that he said, asking about the four castes, he wasn't asking about whether there's any difference in this life, but about the future. The word he used is dhyatadhammikam, means this life. Dhyatta means visible. Dhamma, okay, so visible phenomena, literally, but it's an idiom meaning in this very lifetime, whereas samparayika is the idiom that's used to mean in the beyond. Okay, so here's the question. Kimpana bhante atideva. Atideva, do devas exist? Do gods exist, literally? And the Buddha doesn't reply to that quite directly, but he says, King Pana Twang Maharaja Evangadesi. And then why? But why? Pana has a but. But why do you ask that question? But are there devas? Do devas exist? Well, I was asking if, Bhante, there are devas who come back to this world, or who are not ones who come back to this world. So to come back to ittattan is a phrase literally meaning thisness, but it's always used to mean basically this realm of existence. So are there, whether these devas come back to this world or don't come back, I mean, it's a very curious kind of thing. First he's asking whether they exist or not, and then he's saying, well, what I really want to know is whether they get, whether they come back to this world or not. Okay?
As human.
Well, presumably, yeah. It just says thisness, but the commentary glosses it as manusaloka, meaning this world, the human world. So, a number of possibilities here. Now, I believe from some footnotes by Analio and Bhikkhu Bodhi that K.R. Norman has done an analysis of this sutta, I think based on this particular passage, and has suggested some emendations to it. I'm not sure what they are, but there's sort of a slight note of scepticism. Analio notes that K.R. Norman's emendations are not supported by the Chinese text, so... A correction to the text, presumably because of the somewhat curious nature. The question, Atideva or do devas exist, has a implication. So the one possibility here is simply that King Vasenadi was a bit confused, which is not an implausible kind of assumption. Another possibility is that there's some textual corruption and that the text should be supposed to make sense in some kind of way. But there's also an implication, and I wonder whether it may be relevant or not. Ati, in similar kinds of context, Ati has an implication of exist eternally. So I'm kind of wondering whether in phrasing that question, Pasenadi saying, do devas live forever? Which would then make sense in regard to the second one. Do they come back here or not, or do they just stay wherever they are forever? So, not entirely certain.
The existence of devas is common knowledge to humans.
Well, I mean, Pasenadi has already kind of implied he believes in rebirth. He's already said, I'm talking, you know, not about this life, but about the beyond. So it would imply he believes in some kind of rebirth. There certainly is a strain of scepticism in ancient India. So there's some people who didn't believe in devas and so on. So he could have been asking that question. But the question is whether he actually was or not. Anyway, so the Buddha's answer to that, those great king, those gods who are still subject to ill will, sabhyapajja, those gods will come back to this state, tatang, and those gods who are no longer subject to ill will do not come back to this state. Okay, so this is presumably referring to the anagami. Okay, so the anagami is completely got rid of ill will. And they never come back. Okay, so this word sabhyapajja is ambiguous and can either mean subject to ill will, as Bhikkhu Bodhi has, or it can be subject to affliction, so that suffering devas. But as most plausibly here, it means subject to ill will. When this was said, the general Vidudaba, and here we have his name spelt Vitatubho. Vitatubha, that's a very curious non-Pali kind of name. Sanisura has Vidudaba. When this was said, General Vidudaba asked the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, can those gods who are still subject to ill will and who come back, so this is, Tanisura has the afflicted devas here, can those gods who are still subject to ill will and who come back to this human state topple or banish from that place those gods who are no longer subject to ill will and who do not want to come back to this human state? Mm-hmm. So, something's on his mind when he's asking that question. And probably getting some kind of insight into the relationship between political discourse and religious discourse in ancient India, and also interesting note that like the word deva is used as a term of address for a king. Okay, so when it's talking about toppling the kings from the devas from their place, it has a certain resonance. And you know, if you think about things like, say, the Iliad, where you constantly have this sort of interchange between the sort of the intrigues and the politicking among the gods, and then the intrigue and politicking amongst the relevant kings and so on, who they're supporting. This is the kind of thing that's going on all the time. So then Venerable Ananda thought, this general Vidurabha is the son of King Pasenadi of Kosala, and I am the son of the Blessed One. Now is the time for the son to talk with the son. This being one of the passages which show that Ananda was not of the same age as the Buddha. So according to the Pali tradition, Theravadan tradition, Ananda and the Buddha were born on the same day. And this being a belief which has caused a great deal of confusion in reconstructing the chronology of early Buddhism. And in fact, all of the early evidence suggests that he was in fact about a generation younger than the Buddha, and so calling himself figuratively the son of the Blessed One, being the same generation as Vidurabha. And Pasenadi, as we saw in the Dhammacetia Sutta, Pasenadi himself is in fact the same age as the Buddha. And Ananda said to General Vidurabha, "General, I shall ask you a question in return. Answer it as you choose. General, what do you think? There is the whole extent of King Pasenadi of Kosala's realm where he exercises lordship and sovereignty. Now, can King Pasenadi of Kosala topple or banish from that place any recluse or Brahmin, irrespective of whether that recluse or Brahmin has merit or not, and whether he leads the holy life or not? He can do so, sir. What do you think, General? There is the whole extent that is not King Pasenadi of Kosala's realm, where he's not exercised lordship and sovereignty. Now can King Pasenadi of Kosala topple or banish from that place any recluse or Brahmin, irrespective of whether he has merit or not, or leads the holy life or not? He cannot do so. General, what do you think? Have you heard of the gods of the 33? And Vidurabha says, "Yes, sir, I've heard of them, and King Pasenadi of Kosala has heard of them as well. General, what do you think? Can King Pasenadi of Kosala topple the gods of the 33 or banish them from that place? So King Pasenadi of Kosala cannot even see the gods of the 33. So how could he topple them or banish them from that place?" So this being the subject of one of the most famous and widespread of all the Jataka stories, the Mandahata Jataka, being the story of a king who was not satisfied with his merit and power, and he conquered the whole world and ruled over incomparable wealth for an incalculable period of time, but wasn't satisfied with that until he wanted to take over the heaven of the 33 gods. And even though he was invited there and invited to share the throne with Sakka, the king of the gods, he still wasn't satisfied and wanted to topple Sakka from his throne, and that was just too much, and so he got tossed down to earth and lost everything. So probably being a thought on a certain king's mind, I don't know. Ananda's response: those gods who are still subject to ill will and who can come back to this human state cannot even see those gods who are no longer subject to ill will and who do not come back to this human state. So how could they topple them or banish them from that place? So again, referring to the gods of the pure abodes. Then King Pasenadi of Kosala asked the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, what is this bhikkhu's name? His name is Ananda, great king. Ananda he is indeed, Venerable Sir, and Ananda he appears. What the Venerable Ananda has said appears reasonable. What he has said appears to be supported by reason." Okay.
Given that unfortunate answer that Ananda gave.
Why is that?
There's two level discourses, about differentiation based on virtue.
Yeah.
And another about boundaries based on practical jurisdiction.
Sorry, say it again.
Okay, so entry into the pure abode, virtue,
your
meditative attainment.
Yeah.
So you can talk about it in those terms.
Yeah.
But you can also talk about the difference in terms of the practical jurisdiction, that is, the gods of 33 can't even see, can't even touch the gods in the pure abodes. And so what Vidurabha walks away with, what he sees as reasonable, is basically, well, I can seek in Pasenadi.
Oh, yeah.
I have practical jurisdiction over him.
Yeah.
Regardless of the difference between he and I in virtue, I can topple him.
Yeah, well, yeah. Quite true, you can see him. Oh. Obviously.
It starts as perhaps a discussion about virtue,
yeah,
but then gets twisted into, unfortunately, twisted into something like machiavellian.
So, definitely subjects here. Interesting, the divergence between the two texts we've got here, that here Tanisaro just goes straight, what a joy he is, but Lord, are there Brahmas? And Bhikkhu Bodhi has, he is joy, what he said appears reasonable, what he said appears supported by reason. So we've got an extra sentence in there in Bhikkhu Bodhi's version, which may well be the difference between the Thai and Burmese editions. Let me just have a look here. What have we got? And again, he said, yeah, this is the response by King Pasenadi. Ananda Watabho, he is indeed joy. Ananda Rupo Watabho, okay, and he appears joyful, or is a form of joy. What he says is, so this has the bit about being reasonable here. So I'm not quite sure what the textual situation. It could be just a mistake in Tanisaro's translation, or it could be a different reading in the different editions. Not sure. But also another slightly kind of unusual thing. Now, if this is really a discourse with Vidudaba, and if it's really Vidudaba actually scheming to overthrow the king, which he does a bit later on when the king's 80 and Vidudaba is already a mature man, then how come they haven't heard of Ananda? I mean, the Dhammacetia Sutra is said in the last year of the Buddha's life. Here, the Pasenadi and the Buddha are both 80. And yet here, no one seems to have heard of Ananda. So this, is again, is slightly unusual. So Pasenadi surely isn't that dumb. And I think we've had Ananda in other discourses with Pasenadi, and we've had Ananda going to the harem in the palace and teaching and stuff, so it's a bit kind of odd, isn't it? Could be an earlier one, and then the relationship with Vidudaba becomes unusual. Yeah, and perhaps he was just scheming for many years. No, of course, but you do know that, and the people who wrote the text knew that. There's always this default setting. You can read a text and assume it doesn't mean anything.
But the question is, can
one order of devas overthrow another order of devas, being the question that's not asked, as far as I know, anywhere else in the sutras?
It's
a bit specific.
Thinking about
Davis,
being at war, it's a bit sort of, it seems like...
Oh, well, Davis are at war quite a lot.
They hide each other.
Of course they do.
That's all they do.
Well, that was Pasenadi's question originally. No, not really. So it's really we're really just speculating. So of course, yeah, it's just a speculation, but it's simply that it's very reasonable to read it as having all those implications, and yet somehow an underthing. I mean, another possibility, which is also another thing, is that Ananda only became well known You know, that we have this idea, according to the conventional history, that he was actually the Buddha's attendant and with him for the last 25 years of the Buddha's life, but perhaps that wasn't the case. Perhaps he only became associated with him much later, and it was only in the last few years, so that might be another explanation. But anyway, we can't solve all the problems, but to really, if you really want to get to grips with these things and solve them, obviously it takes detailed study, and even then, you know, you can only end up with tentative answers. But just at the moment, we can just sort of note that there seems to be these unusual features of the text. No. It's Ananda is a common name, but it's the same Ananda. Okay, so then the next question. But Lord, are there Brahmas? Okay? Ati Brahma. Does Brahma exist forever? And then again the same exchange. Why do you ask? I was asking whether Brahma comes back to this human state or not. But King, any Brahma who is still subject to ill will comes back to this human state, and any Brahma who is no longer subject to this ill will does not come back to this human state, which of course refutes my previous statement that this is all talking about the pure abodes, because all the devas in the pure abodes are supposed to be Brahmas, so that's all completely refuted. But anyway, yeah, probably just the slightly wobbly nature of the text, I would imagine.
Is it also possible that the devas in the pure also are Brahmas?
Yeah.
So the Brahmins, they are only in the pure abodes, would you say?
The pure abodes are sort of kind of like above the Brahma realms.
So they call the
Yeah, but Brahmas are a kind of deva.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're So it's just a matter of nomenclature, really.
Doesn't the Brahma refer to the first jar or five ones for devas with
him? I think generally it's all the devas in the, you know, and they usually just call the Brahma loka. But yeah, I think you're certainly right in terms of what's most normally talked about, that the that there's like Mahabrahma and the Brahma of the first jhana realm that are commonly referred to as Brahma, but I think generally speaking it's all of them.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah, they're still called devas. Yeah.
So there needs to be a diagram, I think.
Oh yeah, there's plenty of them. So this is Wikipedia's got all the details. So down the bottom I have the hell realms, animal realm, hungry ghost realm, human realm. Okay, then the gods of desire. And so this is the karma loka realm of, and this is the karma deva. Four great kings, according to this, always drunk. I've never actually heard that before. Wouldn't surprise me though. Bearing garlands and the bowl in hand. I'm not sure where he gets these descriptions from. Then the gods who have the 33 at their heads. I'm not sure where he gets that from. It's the 33 gods, the gods of the 33, the number 33 being conventional, obviously, and it's never actually explained in the Buddhist text what the 33 are. I think the Hindu texts do at some stages. Sakka is the king of the 33, but the number 33 itself is just a strength or a duplication of the Trinity as the kind of conventional number for gods.
So is that meant to be a devas?
Of course, yeah. Everything about the human realm is all devas. Devas is a very generic term. Absolutely, yeah. It's just very very commonly found as the Trinity. So you find groups of Trinities found all over the place.
So like going right back.
Yeah, yeah. So for example, in Greece you have Zeus, Poseidon, and the three brothers, Poseidon and what's his name? In the ocean, and then his name Hades, who's under the earth, one in the sky, the water, and the sea.
Oh, okay.
And in various places, in the ancient Vedas and so on, you also have different trinities and things. Yeah. So it's quite a common notion. And also you have triple goddesses as well as the triple gods. Like at the Judgment of Paris, you have Athena, Hera, and Aphrodite. So, 33 being an early kind of reunification.
Gods of design.
Yeah.
Sounds
like a rock band, doesn't it? That'd be a great name for a band, wouldn't it? Oh, that's not too bad.
Are they all gods?
No, there's plenty of Sheilas.
So
I'm
all quite sure what you mean by there's a scale of contradiction.
Sorry?
The answer to Sandy's question about the rebirth of Brahma is because his original question is about the
It's not a contradiction. If he was referring to where are the two questions different? That's all. So if he was really referring to the pure abodes in the first time, then how is that different to his second question?
Raising the difference
between not pure abodes, but the difference between devas and brahmas. Yeah, which wouldn't seem to have much of a difference. Brahmas are devas. Yeah, in the pure abodes, they're both brahmas and devas. It's not a big deal. It's not a big difference.
But all these figures and names and stuff, are they actually from the canonical sources?
No, the years that they have here, these are, I'm not quite sure where these are from. These are probably from some commentarial or post-canonical sources. I'm not sure if these are from the Pali sources or not.
Hindu.
At the top, it's Hindu, and Buddhist. This is a specifically Buddhist scheme.
What's
Kalpa? Eon. No, this basic scheme is found in every school. Okay, so this the basic list of these devas and so on is found in the suttas. The actual period of times, these are celestial years, not human years. Okay. And so one celestial year is heaps of human years, of course.
And heaps is the number? Or?
Heaps is a metric term, yes.
So this is always going to be an advantage?
I don't know. I haven't heard that bit before. That may be a Tibetan bit, I don't know. But anyway, the gods, 33 gods, Yama, Deva. Yama, Deva doesn't really mean the god of death, but Yama in traditional Hindu iconography is often the god of death. But this is really not similar to that. It's just a name that's used here. Then the Tusita Devas, blissful gods. Those who delight in creating, the Nimanarati Deva. And then the rulers over things created by others, the Paranimitta Vasavati Devas. So this one is Buddhist cosmology. The literary critics have a higher position in the cosmology than the creators of the artworks themselves. So obviously being... Yeah, and Mara lives in that one, in the top one there. So these are all, these ones you get to through conventional dana, keeping precepts and so on. If you sort of do bad karma, of course you go into the three lower realms. If you do good karma, you go into the human realm or one of the highest ones. So these are all, you get into these ones through doing conventional good karma. So acts of kindness, acts of charity, and so on, and also meditation short of reaching jhana. And so the higher realms are all realms that you have to get jhanas to get into, and so these are the Brahma realms and so on. And see, each one has the it's sort of one of the sort of characteristics of the Buddhist cosmology is that the higher you go up, the more finely it all gets divided. Even though there are much fewer beings in those realms. So this is the first jhana realm. You know, the retinue of Brahma, the Brahma Purohita, called Brahma priests, like the attendants, perhaps better, and the great Brahmas. So each first, this is the realm that's produced through the first jhana. But even within that realm, then there are three levels depending on the level of skill that you have in developing jhana and how often you've done it and so on. And then through the second jhana and so on. These numbers of worlds, this is not found in the early suttas and probably, and in fact is the opposite normally in the suttas, that the higher you go up, the less worlds there are rather than the more. And these, the numbers of kalpas that these last for, some of these are found in the suttas, but they're not found exactly as it's put here. What the suttas actually say is that as a result of first jhana, you get reborn for one eon. As a result of second jhana, you get reborn for two eons. As a result of third jhana, you get reborn for four eons. And as a result of fourth jhana, you get reborn for 500 eons. Okay? So that's what the suttas say. And the suttas then go on to say, suttas then go on to say, just remembering precisely that so these are the infinite realm of infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and neither perception nor non-perception. And the suttas say, these, according to these ones, 20,000 kalpas for the infinity of space, 20,000 kalpas for the infinity of consciousness, and 40,000, and then 60,000 for realm of nothingness. For some, curiously enough, the passage where it talks about that then doesn't define for neither perception nor non-perception. So the time in that realm is only from the later tradition. Here it says 80,000. In the Pali tradition it says 84,000. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's a long time. I mean, imagine how many times you have to watch the reruns. 7 lives, yeah.
Is that 7 human lives?
Can be
in
any realm, yeah.
It seems to be better to be born in one of the lower ones. You get
something
to
the
table. Imagine if you're unsuccessfully up there at the top.
No, it's
not too
bad. Have you tried? I wouldn't
mean. But this schema here, it doesn't seem to incorporate the pure abodes.
Yeah, no, here's the pure abodes here. So we've got the three sets here of three, and then this is the fourth jhana realm, where hapala is the abundant fruit. Now all of these ones are the pure abodes, so this is where the anagamis go. So following this kind of principle, but the kind of pure abodes thing, it doesn't quite sort of nudge in there exactly as, you know, it's a bit kind of shoehorned into the kind of whole scheme. Then the devas, the connected devas, and the I can't remember the names now. And the Siddhasi devas and so on.
No, just the top one, not because.
Yeah, yeah. And so these five different pure abodes. So even among the anagamis, and of course there's not all that many anagamis around, then they're divided into five realms. And it's assumed, according to this cosmology, it's assumed that they have at least fourth jhana. And that's the kind of the power of their rebirth. There's one sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya that talks about devas attaining non-return from the formless realms as well. So it's not the case that all anagamis go into these five realms. They might also be, if they've developed formless jhanas as well, they can also be reborn in the formless abodes and then attain final nibbana from there.
Can you choose to, even if you're in a gallery, you come back anyway, so you do put back?
No.
Rather than do all these years,
no.
You come back to human realm and do quicker.
No. The stuff. Sorry. Time flies when you're having fun, Shirley. Mate, you wouldn't know it. You'd be up there for such a long time. enjoying yourself, blissing out, and then before you know it, poof, finally Nibbana, and that's it.
You don't come back.
No, you don't come back. Yeah. So it's a subjective perception of time. So from our point of view, we would look at it and think it's an incredible long time. From their point of view, they just chill out for a while and then finally burn. Yeah.
What's the point of these time periods?
What's the point of them?
Control.
What's the point of a cosmology? In one sense, I'm not.
I'm asking what do they mean?
I'm just trying to think of what. I mean, in a sense, they ultimately the cosmologies derive from astronomy. Okay, so they derive from observing the stars. And that it's from observing the stars that you begin to realize how long the world lasts, because you observe cycles, and then the cycles don't, you know, a year cycle, fair enough, but then why don't the months quite add up with a year? So then you sort of have to sort of try to make them match up, and then you start to observe all the planetary cycles and so on and so forth, and they never quite match up, but they're tantalizingly close, and you think, well, if you kind of ran this model forward another 1,000 turns, you'd reach a point where that kind of matched up.
Right, and also then you get a picture of humans, the Earth, the human realm, right, and then going out.
Yeah.
At these outer reaches, right, obviously, you need a lot more time to get around, kind of thing. Like you get a spatial.
You get a huge spatial picture, exactly, yeah. And so, but it's always assumed in Buddhism and Hinduism, of course, that the Earth is just one of many realms. So this is sort of extrapolating everything in time, but there's also the spatial extrapolation as well.
Yeah.
So you've got a picture of our realm as being just like a tiny fragment in this huge cosmos.
And that gives a circular picture of time.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, very much so, yeah. So, and then that gives plenty, because if you know, when you come from Indian cosmology and you come back to Greek cosmology, it seems so cramped. You know, I mean, the gods are just around the corner. I mean, you just kind of, you know, the whole journey of the Odyssey is like, you know, trottling around a couple of islands, you know, and Olympus is kind of just over there, and you know, there's all the gods are sitting in a hall about this size around a table eating dinner, you know, and it's so tiny and shrunken world. It's very domestic, yeah. So Indian cosmology always has this huge kind of expansive aspect. The expansive aspect of it probably is it's speculative, but probably is an inheritance from Mesopotamia and Sumer, because that's where they first did the kind of huge astrological calculations and developed those really big numbers. So those big number systems probably were interpreted from there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. From the Middle East, from like Mesopotamia and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, because you get a sense that there must be a lot more knowledge built into these systems, which then gets lost, you know,
right,
when it comes down to a table like this, and you know,
exactly.
You've explained it, so it's much more meaningful, but
it becomes very conventionalized, yeah.
But you know, if you know how to just, you're not being in any of this,
that's right. That's where you want to go, right?
Yeah.
No, but I mean, if that's the highest reward to just get the nirvana, why? It's kind of an upside scale, you know what I mean? It's like you go to these late years to have a chance to come back to your life and then get to Nibbana. But on the other hand, so if you get to Arahant, then you don't have to bother with all this.
Yeah.
But if you have a little bit less, then you have to spend all this time.
Yeah.
The scale is upside down. Instead of less time,
you
spend more time.
Yeah, so. You spend less time objectively, if there is such a thing as objective, but you don't spend less time subjectively.
Yeah, I understand that, but I mean, the people who invented that were humans, and it's,
because the notion of Nibbana as a notion is not an explanatory principle which generates the table. The notion of Nibbana is a transcendent principle, which is a teaching for people who have already understood something like this, yeah, but then dissatisfied for it and want something else. So that they're kind of the general Indian cosmology, they would have had some vaguely conceived cosmological conceptions, which the Buddhist theorists, now whether the Buddha himself did this or certainly wasn't long after the Buddha, took all of those things and then arranged it in a fairly neat form, and everyone did that. The Jainas did it in their own way, the Brahmins did it in their own way, and it's always picking up bits and pieces from different animist beliefs, from things from the Vedas and so on, and trying to make sense of it all. And the period of time is one of the basic organizational principles that they use to be able to actually classify everything. So in a sense, it's a way of making sense of the kind of complex and convoluted stuff in Indian cosmology. And even in that sense, it doesn't really work, because if you even keeping yourself on a very literal level and confining yourself very literally to what's in the Pali Canon, there are plenty of passages of different kinds of gods and things like that who don't actually really appear in this list. And you can kind of shoehorn them in one category or the other, but they just appear from nowhere with different kinds of names or attributes. For example, you have in the Petavattu, you have people who are born who are pretas in the night time and devas in the daytime. Yeah? Yeah? Yeah. So which kind of realm is that?
Are you human?
Yeah. Well, exactly, yeah. And so, you know, I mean, certainly, I think there's no doubt that the cosmology itself is largely a sort of conventional thing.
So the Buddhist is the Nibbana is like, it's a counter to all this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But also the other, sorry to interrupt, Danny, but the other sort of more specifically Buddhist meaning of it is that each domain in the cosmology corresponds with a particular state of consciousness, yeah? And in particular with these jhana realms and so on. That's why that's very clear. So that's the specifically Buddhist characteristic of it, that it's clearly analysed in terms of discernibly different states of consciousness, which we call jhanas.
But that was also when the Buddha went to the stages.
That's right. That's right. But if you look at the text literally, what it says is, you know, one of them says that it declares the base of nothingness, and another one declares the basis of neither perception nor non-perception.
Yeah.
They don't talk about the whole cosmological scheme.
Yeah.
So whether they actually had that already or not is a bit uncertain at the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, there's the connection between the psychological stability of the different meditative impediments and the
exactly, yeah, which is one of the interesting things about the length of time. So if you think about it, first jhana, one kalpa, second jhana, two kalpas, third jhana, four kalpas, and then the fourth jhana is 500 kalpas. So obviously the fourth jhana is a lot stabler than the others, and then in the arupas is even vastly more.
So in the and lots of the suttas, when it's describing the different, you know, streamers and Anagami, is it like with the Anagami, it's goes, I can't remember the exact word, it goes to the pure abodes and they retain spine without the return to this world.
Yeah.
So does that mean that they sort of move around in the pure abodes, or will be guaranteed that, you know, wherever they sort of land?
Yeah, yeah. They can. Yeah. Different pure abodes, different anagamis will go differently. Some will attain parinibbana in between, so they die as anagamis, and then before they get reborn, they'll become arahants.
Mm-hmm.
Others become arahants as soon as they land in their new existence.
Mm-hmm.
And other ones might last there for a while in that existence and then become arahants. And other ones might drift upwards through the different realms and become arahants from the top.
And is this meant to be a sort of automatic process, or you just keep watching your breath?
Well, Pretty much it's automatic, yeah. I mean, but that would be the difference, is that those who are actually putting more effort into it would probably go faster, yeah? Yeah. Sorry? Oh, yeah. Well, if you're an anagami, you won't come back as a human. Even as a deva, then there's no need to come back as a human. Yeah. Ordinary deva.
When the Buddha used all of the Islam names and talked about the deva, how literally we should take it?
I don't know.
Because when you meet the sutras, you get this kind of whole cosmos of neighbors and ideas about where things are.
Mm. Okay. Well, as a guide for interpretation, think about the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Mm-hmm. Right? The Buddha's talking to the five ascetics. He teaches them the four noble truths. He says the second noble truth is yayan tanha pono bhavika, that craving that leads to further rebirths. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ending of suffering is the ending of that craving that leads to further rebirth. Now that's how rebirth is talked about in the actual Four Noble Truths, which is actually the core part of the discourse as actually spoken by the Buddha himself, and which is found in exactly the same form in 17 or more versions across every school and every Buddhist language. Okay? Now then at the end of the discourse, spoken by a person or persons unknown, from sources or sources unknown, is packed a bit where it says that the devas then rejoiced in the Buddha's words, and the message that the Buddha has rolled forth the wheel of the Dhamma is then passed up through the different deva realms. Now that's the earliest occurrence of this actual list. Okay, it doesn't do all the Brahma realms, but it does the Karma Loka of devas, and it goes up through there, and that list is found in some versions, it's not found in other versions, and it's not spoken by the Buddha, and it's obviously not central to the message of the sutta itself, but it's more giving some gloss on it and making it a bit more exciting. It's the CGI on the text, yeah, not the serious character development of the thing. So I think that's how we should really understand it, that the notions of rebirth and so on definitely should be taken seriously, but that the details of how the cosmology are presented are pretty much conventional, and I think the principles behind them are valid, but whether there are actually gods who go around saying yes, say where do you live, and you say here I am at 27 Yama realm or something like that, I don't know. Yeah. Here's the Wikipedia article, which gives lots more fantastic information there.
What
is that?
Is
and this. Do they say anything that we've already? No, it doesn't say they're all drunken. No. So it's got all their names and which ones they're from and all the different kind of hell realms. Okay. Okay, let's move along. The messenger comes back with the person, remember, who was asked about who brought this story about whether the Buddha said that you can be omniscient, and he's now come back. The man announced to King Pasenadi of Kosala, great King Sanjaya, the Brahman of the Akahasa clan, has come. King Pasenadi of Kosala asked Sanjaya, Brahman, who introduced this story to the palace? Sire, it was General Viludaba. Viludaba said, sorry, it was Sanjaya, the Brahman of the Akasa clan. And then a man announced to King Pasenadi of Kosala, sire, it is time to depart. So So classic piece of dialogue there. They're talking about Brahmas and rebirth. They sort of bust in. Who asked this question? He said it. No, he said it. He said it. Well, it's time to go now. So then they're off. And everything gets completely unresolved. But yeah, it certainly gives an insight into Vidudava's character there. King Pasenadi then said to the Buddha, "Venerable Sir, we've asked about omniscience. Let's have an answer about omniscience. We proved and accept that answer, and we're satisfied. We asked about purification in the four castes. Let's have an answer. We approve of that answer, and we're satisfied. We asked about the gods, and we asked about the Brahmas. Let's have an approved. We approve of that answer, and so we're satisfied. Now, Venerable Sir, we depart. We are busy and have much to do. You may go, Great King, at your own convenience." And Blessed One, King Pasenadi of Kosala, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. Very much so, yeah. Yeah, he's always trying to do the right thing, but yeah. Vidudava? Yeah. Excusing him in what way?
Oh, in that King Pasenadi seems fairly inept, like,
worthy
of being overthrown.
Yeah, by someone much more ruthless than Machiavelli. Well, exactly. He didn't do too bad. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, perhaps he was.
Often the favourite kind of kings are easily manipulated by the ministers. It's just a little bit of doesn't mean real power.
So, just checking through Venerable Analia's comparative study, there's not a whole lot in there in terms of interesting differences between the Pali and other versions of it. So that's the end of the Rajavaga. Next week we'll move on to the Brahmanavaga, starting with the Brahmayu Sutta, which is a fantastic, very inspiring, very powerful discourse with the Buddha talking with one of the most venerable of the Brahman caste, and gives a quite interesting and detailed description of the Buddha and his personal conduct, which is the only place where that passage appears in the sutta. Oh yeah, we'll have to look at the 32 signs of the Great Note. Yeah. Okay. So let's finish by paying respects.